This is part three of a multi-week study of Mystery Babylon, where I'm going to go verse by verse through Revelation chapters 17 and 18. There should be a link wherever you found this video or podcast to the previous studies in the notes that accompany it. This entire study is available in multiple formats, video, MP3, or text at versebyversebibleteaching.com. Okay, so picking up where we left off last time, Revelation 17:7 says, "And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman, and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath seven heads and ten horns." So the angel here is going to tell John what it is he's been seeing so far. There are many examples in Scripture of a prophet seeing a vision that they did not fully understand until the angel interprets the vision for them. We find examples of this in Daniel, Zechariah, and several times in the book of Revelation. This next phrase, "And I will tell thee the mystery of the woman, and of the beast that carrieth her, which has the seven heads and ten horns." This is so important to keep in mind that there are two distinct characters in this vision, the woman known as Mystery Babylon and the seven-headed, ten-horned beast that she rides. Mystery Babylon, which the angel will later say is a city, is riding the seven-headed, ten-horned beast, which is the Antichrist. This seven-headed, ten-horned beast will later turn on her and kill her in Revelation 17:12-16. I emphasize that these two are distinct because some folks, when studying these passages that we'll be talking about today, forget this distinction, and failing to see that can cause an incorrect understanding of this prophecy. Moving on to verse 8. "The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is." So the angel begins to talk to John about the seven-headed, ten-horned beast that is mentioned in the previous verse. Let's also go back to the very beginning of this particular vision in Revelation 17, where we can see the full description that John gives to the seven-headed, ten-horned beast. He says that it is scarlet-colored, full of names of blasphemy, and having seven heads and ten horns. Here we also pick up the additional information that this seven-headed, ten-horned beast was also scarlet and was full of names of blasphemy. This is the same description given to the beast four chapters earlier in Revelation chapter 13, which is about the Antichrist. The beast in that chapter also has seven heads, ten horns, and has names of blasphemy. This is not coincidental, nor is it the only time in our verse, Revelation 17:8, that there is an explicit reference to Revelation chapter 13 about the Antichrist beast. In fact, I intend to show that almost no new information is given by the angel in this verse. The new information from the angel about this beast will come after this verse, but verse 8 here almost serves as a very long reintroduction to the Antichrist beast of Revelation 13, using titles and descriptions of him that are already clearly established. Take, for example, the part of this verse that says that those that, quote, dwell on the earth, or the earth dwellers, which is a kind of technical term for those that are unsaved, as it clarifies here by adding that, quote, their names are not written in the book of life. These earth dwellers will worship the beast that was and is not and yet is. Now, this is not new information to John in Revelation 17, because he wrote the exact same description of the beast in Revelation 13, using identical language. For example, Revelation 13:8 says, "And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." The angel, back in our verse, is calling to remembrance the beast that John has already seen with these exact phrases and descriptions. We will see that even the little things, like the earth dwellers, quote, wondering in Revelation 17:8, is also a reference to them wondering at the beast in chapter 13. This next phrase, "was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition," this phrase gives people a great deal of difficulty, and so we will spend quite a lot of time on it. I intend to show that this idea of was and is not and coming out of the bottomless pit is a title referring to the Antichrist's having been miraculously healed or resurrected from the dead. The last phrase in this verse, "the beast that was and is not and yet is," being another way to say the exact same thing. That is, that he lives, he dies, and he seems to rise again and will ultimately go to destruction or perdition. It's sort of a chronology of his entire career on earth, and it functions as a title on several occasions in the book of Revelation. Before I begin to explain the details of this, we need to refresh our memories to the significance that the Bible puts on the seeming resurrection of the Antichrist from the dead. Let's review Revelation chapter 13, which is primarily about the Antichrist, to make sure we understand this preliminary idea. In the relatively short chapter of Revelation 13, it mentions three times the fatal wound of the Antichrist beast that was healed, the first instance being in verse 3. It says, "And I saw one of his heads, as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" It seems to imply here that the world's worship of the beast is directly connected to his deadly wound being healed. It says that they wondered after him, saying, "Who can make war with him?" This is the exact same word used in our current verse, wondered, and it is in the exact same context, that is, wonder from the earth dwellers associated with worship and the resurrection of the dead. This is one of the first descriptions of the Antichrist that we are given in the book of Revelation. Right after the symbolic imagery of verse 1 and 2, this is the first thing that we are told about the beast, that he has a deadly wound that is healed. The Bible, as we will see, considers this event very important, if not preeminent. By the second reference of this event in verse 12, the idea of a healed deadly wound has become a title or identifying description of the beast. Here it distinguishes between the first beast from the second by adding the clarification, "whose deadly wound was healed." And so it says in Revelation 13:12, "And he," speaking of the false prophet, "exerciseth all the power of the first beast," that is, the Antichrist, "before him, and causes all the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed." And here in the third reference in 13:14, we see that the healed deadly wound is again used as a title or distinguishing characteristic of the Antichrist beast. Here it says, "And," speaking of the false prophet here, "he deceiveth him that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had the power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live." So here again we see this idea of a resurrection being used as a title to distinguish which beast they're talking about. So this phrase, "was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit," is basically just another way of saying the same thing. It is an identifier as to which beast we're talking about. It's the one that was, lived, is not, died, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, or come back from the dead. Arthur Pink, an early English Bible scholar who wrote extensively on the Antichrist, agrees. He says the following, "A further reference to the resurrection of the Antichrist, his coming forth from the bottomless pit, is found in Revelation 17:8. It is to be noted that the earth dwellers wonder when they behold the beast that was alive and is not, now alive and yet is, raised again. The world will then be presented with the spectacle of a man raised from the dead." Pink, as well as many other people, associate the phrase "coming out of the bottomless pit" in Revelation 17:8 with the apparent resurrection of the Antichrist in Revelation 13. We will see explicit biblical proof of this interpretation at the end of today's study. The Bible uses the word abyss, which is translated here as bottomless pit, in many different ways. It is a prison for spirits in Mark chapter 5. It's almost synonymous with the abode of the dead in the Old Testament. This word abyss is also the same word that the Apostle Paul uses to describe where Jesus went during at least part of the 3 days in which he was dead before he resurrected. For context, I'll start at verse 6 of Romans 10, 6 and 7. "But the righteousness which is of faith speaketh on this wise, Say not in thine heart, Who shall ascend into heaven, that is, to bring Christ down from above, or Who shall descend into the deep," that word there is abyss, that is, to bring up Christ again from the dead. So the same word for bottomless pit or abyss is also the place where Christ came out of when he resurrected. We find more detail on this event in Acts 2, verses 27 through 32. This is during Pentecost, where Peter will start off in this quote by quoting from the Old Testament. He says, "Because thou wilt not leave my soul in hell," that word there is Hades, "neither wilt thou suffer thine Holy One to see corruption, Thou hast made known to me the ways of life. Thou shalt make me full of joy with thy countenance. Then he continues, Men and brethren, let me freely speak unto you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his sepulture is with us unto this day. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God has sworn with an oath to him, that of the fruit of his loins, according to the flesh, he would raise up Christ to sit on the throne. He, seeing this before, spake of the resurrection of Christ, that his soul was not left in hell, again Hades here, neither his flesh did see corruption. This Jesus hath God raised up, whereof we are all witnesses. Now, this is interesting because here the word Hades was mentioned as the place where Jesus' soul went when he died, when Paul says that it was the abyss. But we can see that contextually they are both talking about the place where Jesus' soul went during his death. My point is not to do an exhaustive theological study on this subject, but only to show you that Jesus went to the abyss at some point during his death. He may have also went to other locations in Hades, such as Paradise or even Tartarus. There are more references to this event in which I will leave for you to study further. Ephesians 4, 8-10, 1 Peter 3, 18-20, 2 Peter 2, 4-5, Matthew 12, 38-45, Luke 23, 43. My only point is that coming up from the abyss can be shown from Scripture to mean resurrection from the dead. So, these phrases are used like a title referring to the Antichrist's apparent resurrection from the dead. It is as if it's a chronology of his career and a title at the same time. He is the beast that lives, dies, resurrects, and ultimately meets his doom in perdition or in the lake of fire in Revelation 19:20. So I would suggest that the following phrases are all referring to not only the same person, the Antichrist, but the same identifying event in that person's life, his apparent resurrection. The beast that was and is not and yet is, the beast that was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition, the first beast whose deadly wound was healed, the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit, and one more very interesting one that we will look at later. I should briefly mention before I get into this next point that I'm not dogmatic about it, and if you disagree with me, it won't matter in the big picture of our study of these great chapters of Revelation 17 and 18. But it is my conviction that the Antichrist is not being referred to in another passage in Revelation 9 during the fifth trumpet, even though the bottomless pit is mentioned there as well. It's in Revelation 9 verse 11 and it says, And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. First, it should be noted that this angel is nowhere said to be itself from the bottomless pit, or having come out of the bottomless pit. It is simply ruling over and directing the beings that do come out of it, and making sure that they do what they are supposed to. RevelationCommentary.org notes, quote, The angel of the abyss is identified as king over the horrible locust-like creatures. The exact identity of this angel is not certain. The particular grammatical construction, genitive of subordination here, indicates that this angel is over the bottomless pit. It does not say that the angel is from the bottomless pit. There are many reasons that I don't see these two figures, the angel named Abaddon or Apollyon, and the beast we know as Antichrist, being the same. A few reasons would be that this passage in Revelation 9 would constitute the only time in Scripture that the Antichrist is referred to as an angel and not a man. It would also be the only verse in Scripture that connects the Antichrist with things like the fifth trumpet, or ruling over a five-month physical torment of only wicked people, or his name being Destroyer. It seems much more likely that this passage should simply be taken at face value. The fifth trumpet here, about the locusts being let out to torment those who do not have the seal of God for 5 months, seems to be no different than the other trumpet or bowl judgments, in the sense that they have mostly godly angels oversee the destruction of the wicked. I see no reason that this should be taken out of the context of the simplicity and limited nature of the fifth trumpet. All that has happened in the fifth trumpet is that the destroying angel, that's what Abaddon and Apollyon means, oversees the entities that torment the earth, an event that lasts for 5 months and 5 months alone. That's it. There's no other mention of this angel as having further purpose in the end-time scenario. It may very well be that the entities that are let out of the abyss are demonic spirits, but the angel who rules over them makes sure that they only target the ungodly, and only for 5 months. The function of this angel is like the destroying angel of Exodus, in the sense that the godly are passed over to kill the ungodly. And almost no one disagrees that in Exodus it was an angel of God, if not God himself, designated as the destroying angel. Or consider 1 Chronicles 21:15, where we see an unambiguous case of a godly angel designated as a destroying angel. This is where David had sinned in the taking of the census. It says, "And God sent an angel unto Jerusalem to destroy it, and he was destroying. The Lord beheld, and he repented him of the evil. And he said to the angel that destroyed, It is enough, stay now thine hand. And the angel of the Lord stood by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And David lifted up his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord stand between the earth and the heaven, having a drawn sword in his hand stretched out over Jerusalem." Again, I'm not dogmatic about that, and it doesn't matter if you agree or disagree with that in the grand scheme of things. But there is one more speculative rabbit trail that I would like to go down before we go back to our verse. And you may think this doesn't have a lot to do with our passages, but trust me, there's a reason why I want to look closer at some of this stuff. We need to discuss this idea of the resurrection of the Antichrist, because not only does it have huge theological implications, it will also directly affect our study. After all, if Satan can raise the dead, then it can bring into question some very core Christian theology. Most good scholars, when they talk about this apparent resurrection of the Antichrist, say something to the effect of, "We don't know if he actually resurrects or if he only appears to resurrect via some kind of deception." And that's really a good enough explanation. But I think it's important to talk about this for just a second. I do not think that Satan has or will ever have the power to raise people from the dead. But I also don't think that this is some kind of fake resurrection either. I think that all the verses, when put together, suggest a genuine resurrection of the Antichrist. This only leaves one conclusion, at least that I can think of, and that is that God resurrects the Antichrist for some reason. I believe that the answer to why he does this is found in one of the most detailed passages concerning the Antichrist, 2 Thessalonians 2, chapter 2. I will quote a good deal of this passage so you can get the context. "Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God, even him whose coming is after the working of Satan, with all power and signs and lying wonders, and with all deceitfulness and unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." Now, don't get me wrong, there will be all kinds of signs and lying wonders in the end times that will deceive people. The end times will be characterized by deceptions. I've talked a lot about the alien deception that I believe strongly will play a major role in this end time scenario. But there appears to be something else, something that is here called the strong delusion. This is something that God does, not the Antichrist, not the false prophet, but God does for the purpose of making sure that people believe, quote, a lie. It is precisely this connection to the assurance of damnation associated with this event in 2 Thessalonians 2 that gives me confidence in this interpretation. The people that worship the Antichrist, which Revelation 13 directly associated with his resurrection, are also spoken of as synonymous with those whose names are not written in the Book of Life. Again, please, this is not something that I'm dogmatic on, nor would I be the least bit surprised if I'm wrong about this. I only took you on this rabbit trail because I think it will help you think more openly about the following verses. So, back in Revelation 17:8, the angel is about to explain some very interesting details to John about the seven-headed beast that John saw. But this entire verse is basically preliminary. It is simply the restating of the characteristics of the beast in Revelation 13, as to clarify that the beast he saw is the same one he saw in a previous vision. But before we can get to the new information about the beast, there is one more aspect of this verse that must be covered. There are a lot of interpretations that, even though they might understand that these phrases like the beast that was and is not and yet is referring to the Antichrist's resurrection, they will say that the tense of the verses make it necessary for the Antichrist to have lived before the time of John. They will say that since John wrote in the late first century, the past tense of the word was in the first part of the phrase, i.e., the beast that was, means that the beast that will come to live in the future as Antichrist must have lived sometime before the time of John. Common candidates proposed in this scenario are Judas or Nimrod. Again, they are saying that the beast that is yet to come must have been dead already when John was writing. This, I believe, can lead to any number of wrong conclusions about the identity of the Antichrist. They fail to see that John consistently uses these phrases like the beast that was and is not and yet is as a title for the beast of his visions. Visions in which he sees all the way to the end of knowable time in some cases. Yet he never ceases to refer to everything he sees as having happened in the past. For instance, even the New Jerusalem's descent in Revelation 21, which almost universally is considered to be a future event, must have already descended in the first century if this was the correct way to view the text, because John said, quote, "And I saw, past tense, the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down." But more to the specific point about the phrases like was and is not and yet is, if you apply this consistently to the other titles that refer to the Antichrist's resurrection, the theory that the beast must have already existed, like Judas or Nimrod, would quickly break down. So here we have this list of these titles, such as the beast that was and is not and yet is, the beast that was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition, the first beast whose deadly wound was healed, the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit. So if we applied this first century tense idea to these other passages, we must also conclude that the Antichrist not only has lived and died by the time of John, but that his wound had to have already been healed in the first century as well, as it is also referred to in the past tense by John. This would, of course, not be agreed upon by those making this claim, as they would not say that this pre-John character has risen from the dead yet. They would only say that he would have already died before John's time. The answer here is to realize that phrases like the beast that was and is not and yet is, or the beast which had the wound by the sword and did live, or the first beast whose deadly wound was healed, have the same function as being a way to refer to the Antichrist and the event that comes to define not just his life, but the entire end times course of events. And the tense being used is the exact tense you would expect from someone who was trying to refer back to an event that he saw in a vision that consisted of future events. We will see again proof of this in our last verse today. Okay, so we're finally ready to move on to the next verse. I'm going to take verses 9 and 10 together because, as we will see, they're kind of a package deal. So this is when the angel begins to tell us more about the seven-headed, ten-horned beast. First, there's this phrase, "Here is the mind which hath wisdom." I still haven't figured out what this phrase means or why it's here. It says the same thing earlier when it's talking about the mark of the beast. It says, "Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. I think maybe it has something to do with how the next idea should be viewed, but again, I'm not sure. I bet the answer is somewhere in the Old Testament, but I don't know. So let's move on to the next idea in this verse. "The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth, and there are seven kings." Now we come to what I believe is a really misunderstood passage. You may remember that in the first week I said that I've found something like 90 plus characteristics so far of Mystery Babylon. Well, a lot of commentators really seem to think that there's just one characteristic of Mystery Babylon that they have to make fit in their interpretation. And that is that the city of Mystery Babylon must sit on seven hills, which they derive from their interpretation of this verse. Often, they will say that this city on seven hills is Rome, which is famous for its seven hills. But it doesn't stop those who think that Mystery Babylon is Mecca or even Jerusalem from claiming that their city also sits on seven hills. The only problem is that this is not what this verse is talking about at all. There are many ways to show that this is true: grammatically, contextually, logically, and by comparing scripture with other scripture. Let's start with grammar. The key is in this phrase, "and there are seven kings." And that's how it reads in the King James Version, which I've been doing this study in. Other versions render this with a very important distinction. They say that the seven heads of the beast are seven mountains, and the angel further defines these mountains as being seven kings as well, such as the ESV has it here. It says they are also seven kings. You can see the difference. The King James gives us the impression that the angel begins to talk about a totally separate thing when it talks about the kings, where the ESV defines the seven mountains as seven kings, and then begins to give further information about these kings, which we will look at later. Well, the question is, which one is right? Now, you should know that this difference in translation is not an issue with the underlying Greek texts, like the Textus Receptus or the Westcott and Hort. The Greek texts say the exact same thing here, so it's not one of those issues. This issue is simply a matter of translator error. There is near universal agreement among Bible scholars that the grammar here is saying the seven mountains are in fact seven kings. Here we see that this is the way it is translated in almost every major English Bible. Grammatically, the reason for this is that the Greek word eisen, here translated there are, is the third person plural of eimi, meaning I am, which should be rendered they are. When describing the ten horns a few verses later, a similar phrase occurs. There, the King James Version and the New King James Version translate the phrase correctly, without substituting there for they, as is done in verse 10. Now, I am not a Greek scholar, and I would not want anyone to believe me based on my explaining this to you grammatically. So let's move on to showing that the angel is telling us that the seven heads are seven kings by context of the passage and by comparing scripture with other scripture. I want to start by reiterating that all the other times in this chapter 17, that the seven-headed beast with ten horns is mentioned, it seems to go out of its way to use phrases that are used back in Revelation 13. And we saw that the beast in our chapter, Revelation 17, has many of the same characteristics as the one we looked at in Revelation 13. They both have seven heads, ten horns. They both had names of blasphemy on their heads. They both were referred to by their having been killed yet living. They both have earth dwellers wonder at them when they see their apparent resurrection. They both have people whose names were not written in the book of life worship them. I know this seems almost obvious, but you should know that the view that the seven mountains are seven hills of a city prevents people from seeing this most basic point. Our passage goes on to say that one of these heads, which are kings, is the same was and is not king talked about in Revelation 13, which gets the mortal wound. So let's flip back to Revelation 13:3 and check it out. It says, "One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast." So you see here that one of the beast's seven heads is referred to as having a mortal wound. This is an exact match with our verse back in Revelation 17, with the seven mountains being seven kings, if you're willing to admit that Revelation 17:9 about the mountains and kings has nothing to do with physical hills in Rome, or Mecca, or anywhere else. I mean, do we really think that one of the hills in Rome is going to be mortally wounded, and then come back to life, and everyone is going to marvel at one of the hills in Rome, and then begin to worship a particular hill in Rome? That's what you have to believe, or you can just not believe that Revelation 17 and Revelation 13 are talking about the same seven-headed, ten-horned beast with names of blasphemy that receive a mortal wound and are raised again from the dead, and the earth dwellers worship him. I mean, it's obviously a connection that you have to disregard if you want to have these heads be hills in Rome. Okay, moving on to the next phrase, "five of whom have fallen one is, and the other has not yet come. Now this will explain how this seven-headed beast and its heads work. The question I always had with this was, if the seven-headed, ten-horned beast was supposed to be the Antichrist, how come only one of the heads of this Antichrist seems to be in view? The Bible kind of unapologetically disregards the other six heads of this beast as basically unimportant, and really only tells us about one of these heads, that somehow both the entire beast and this one specific head are called the Antichrist. Well, this verse will explain that issue. First of all, this idea of five of whom have fallen, one is and the other has not yet come. So five of these kings have fallen. Fallen, among other things, is a biblical term for having died. Exodus 32:28, 1 Samuel 4:10, 2 Samuel 1:19, 1 Chronicles 5:10. One is, presumably currently living in John's day, and one is yet to come. The beast is the spirit of Antichrist that has manifested itself in the form of kings, particularly Antichrist-like kings, throughout history. In 1 John 2:18, John says, "Children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, so now many Antichrists have come. Therefore, we know that it is the last hour." These five fallen Antichrist-type kings, I believe, can be determined using no other tool than the Bible. These would be kings that are basically obvious types of the Antichrist. For example, Pharaoh during the time of the Exodus, or people like Nebuchadnezzar, who built an image of himself and forced everyone to worship it or be killed, could be a candidate. Or Nimrod, the first world government leader. Or Antiochus Epiphanes, who Daniel spent so much time describing, is clearly a type of Antichrist with his setting himself in the temple and declaring himself to be God. I'm not going to attempt to give you a perfect list of these kings, but I will say that I think that they can be determined using the Bible alone. Some will say that these heads are not physical kings, but rather kingdoms. They do this by adding a step to the angel's interpretation of the seven heads of the beast. The angel says the seven heads are seven mountains, which are seven kings. But they will add a step to this and say that the seven kings are seven kingdoms. They rationalize this by pointing out that in the book of Daniel, kings and kingdoms are pretty much interchangeable terms. Often, before they will take you to our verse in Revelation 17, they will have you agree to the condition that kings mean kingdoms. If you agree, they will have you flip to Revelation 17 and say, "Well, then we know that these kings are not kings, but actually seven kingdoms." This, I believe, is not a good way to interpret the Bible. One reason I think this is that if John wanted to say kingdoms, he had the vocabulary to do so. He certainly does so in other places in the book of Revelation when he refers to the kingdom of Antichrist and various other situations. Another issue is that John is a different writer than Daniel, and he uses the word kings a few times to refer to an obvious individual king. And in Revelation 10, verse 11, he even seems to contrast the kings with kingdoms or nations. He says, "And he said unto me, Thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings." But I think the obvious thing is that the Antichrist in Daniel, Matthew 24, and the parallel passages, 2 Thessalonians, and Revelation is always referred to as a man. He does things that only a man can do. He sits in a temple in Jerusalem and declares himself to be God. He is called a man on several occasions. It says he won't regard the God of his fathers. I could go on, but my point is that it takes twice as much effort to make the Antichrist be a kingdom than it does a king. Unfortunately, there are entire systems of theology that rely on this kings equal kingdoms issue. So you'll have certain groups go to great lengths here to interpret the Bible in an allegorical way to make this king mean kingdom. I would say that the Antichrist will be part of and control specific kingdoms, which is important to the book of Daniel and to the book of Revelation. But the fact that there is a man that moves and rules those kingdoms is attested to over and over again in Scripture. Moving on to this phrase, one is. Again, I'm not going to speculate as to which king was the manifestation of the Antichrist in John's day. as I honestly don't know myself. Some speculate that it was Nero, and I think that's a good possibility, but I've not decided on what my view is on this point yet. So I'll move on to the next verse, which is, "The other has not yet come." This is one that I think we can have more explicit biblical information about. And I will include this phrase as we move on to the final verse that we'll be looking at today, verse 11. So this future head, this future king, this future manifestation of the beast, has at least one specific characteristic mentioned here. It, quote, must continue a short space. This phrase, I believe, is strong evidence that the king that is future is the one that has the fatal wound and yet lives, the Antichrist head, the head we've been discussing in Revelation 13, the one that so much time is spent on. This idea of a short space is good evidence to that effect, in my opinion. By far, the most talked about time period in Bible prophecy is the 3.5 years in which the Antichrist is given to do his thing. It makes reference to this exact period 7 times in Scripture, and talks about the details of it in many more places. It refers to this 3.5 year period in the following ways: 42 months, 1,260 days, and a time times and half a time. It refers to this time period as being a, quote, short time as well. In fact, using the exact words used in Revelation 17:10 when it says in Revelation 12:12, "Therefore rejoice ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe unto the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time." This idea that he must continue a short time seems to match up well with the references about the Antichrist, who has the mortal wound and lives. It says in Revelation 13:5, "And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. Rarely are characteristics of the Antichrist found in only one verse. This idea is backed up in several places. Daniel 7:25 says, "And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change the times and laws, and they shall be given unto his hand until the time and times and the dividing of time." I would propose that the idea of, quote, short space is referring back to the short space given for the dragon to continue in Revelation 12, and the 3.5 year period given to the Antichrist in Revelation 13. It is also to be noticed that 3.5 years is an extremely short time for a king to rule. Other people that want to make the future head, the future king, one that has already been alive in the past, like Nimrod or Judas, will propose that the yet-to-come king of Revelation 17:10 was Hitler, but Hitler ruled about 12 years. The reign of Antichrist is short because it needs to be short. Jesus said of these 3.5 years, which start just as the Antichrist declares himself to be God in the temple, quote, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." Moving on to Revelation 17, verse 11, the last verse. "And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition." Notice first the similarity to this verse, and the one we looked at earlier in Revelation 17:8. 17:8 says, "The beast that thou sawest was, and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, and goeth into perdition." 17:11 says, "And the beast that was, and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition." The difference here is the middle of these two verses, the part about the resurrection. In 17:8, it describes the resurrection as, quote, "ascending out of the bottomless pit." In verse 11, the part that says, "even he is the eighth and is of the seven," is not only, as we will see, being used to convey the exact same thing, that is, the resurrection portion of the Antichrist's chronology, but it is also giving us more information about this event. This phrase, "even he is the eighth and is of the seven," is saying that though there are only 7 kings, there will be 8 reigns. That is, one of these kings will rule twice. The resurrection of Antichrist explains how there can be 8 reigns and only 7 kings. This is almost universally considered to be speaking of a resurrection of one of the dead kings to rule twice. In other words, he will be the 8th king while never ceasing to be one of the seven kings. So, this gives great credibility to the earlier interpretation that this phrase is a technical title of the beast in Revelation 13, and that the bottomless pit in verse 8 is a reference to the beast's resurrection, just as the phrase, even he is the eighth and is of the seven, is a reference to the resurrection. And all of it is packaged in an identical word structure so that we can be confident of our interpretation that this is a title of the Antichrist that refers to his most identifiable trait, his apparent resurrection. Before I conclude the study, I want to read the entire passage that we studied today in context. And because of the translation issue in verse 9, I'm going to be reading from the ESV instead of the usual King James Version. So it says in Revelation 17, 7 through 11, "But the angel said to me, 'Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman, and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction, and the dwellers on the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind of wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is and the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction." Again, this is a multi-week study. This is only part three. If you want to see the other parts, or you want to get this in different formats, video, audio, or text, go to verseByVerseBibleTeaching.com. If you have any feedback or questions or comments or concerns, you can email me at nowheretorun1984@gmail.com. Thanks for your time.